Hi there, I'm Marianne Lozano, president of the Broadleaf Board of Directors and the conference chair for the 9th Annual Broadleaf Writers Conference. This year, our conference will be held Saturday and Sunday, September 21st and 22nd at the Decatur Library in Decatur, Georgia. The 9th Annual Broadleaf Writers Conference offers 2 days of panels, workshops, one-on-one pitch and mentoring sessions, a first pages critique, opportunities to meet and chat with our guest authors and literary agents, and plenty of time to spend with a community of fellow writers in attendance. We strive to attract top-level speakers, both with a track record of success in the industry, as well as those just beginning their careers, with the capacity and desire to help writers on their path to publication. This year, we're thrilled to be headlined by New York Times bestselling author Mary Kay Andrews. Registration for the 9th Annual Broadleaf Writers Conference opens May 1st, so be sure to save the date. To learn more about our conference, I hope you'll visit our website at broadleafwriters.com. See you this fall.
Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of Right Now, a podcast on the craft and business of writing presented to you by Broadleaf Writers Association, based in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm your host, Zachary Steele, and on today's episode, I'm joined by author, podcaster, and indie tabletop game designer Bob Magoo for a deep dive into the pros and cons of self-publishing versus traditional publishing. To learn more about Bob, visit his website at halesbybob.com. All right, let's get rolling. How are you doing today, Bob?
I'm doing great. I've been looking forward to this. I'm excited to be on.
Yeah, glad we could have you. We're going to talk about traditional versus self-publishing because you've had your feet in both ponds there. But there are a couple of things I wanted to cover first. One that kind of allows you to talk a little bit about your book project, but I want to know more about the redneck wizard Howard Marsh and why it is that I shouldn't read all about his adventures, because that sounds fascinating.
that's my main series. I've written a number of things, but my primary series is it's called the Jubal County Saga, and it is about a redneck wizard with a crippling meth addiction in South Alabama. they say write what you know, and I'm from Crenshaw County, Alabama. It's the county with the most dirt roads of any county in the state.
That is something.
Yeah, so it's very rural. Yes. And so I figured, you know, we've got meth, we've got dirt roads, you throw a wizard in the mix, there's probably a book there. And so I've written six so far.
Okay. No, that sounds fascinating. I'll definitely have to check that out. Another thing that you're doing that you promote on your website, which is talesbybob.com, is the Transparency Project. And that seems to lead pretty well into the conversation we're going to have. So what is the Transparency Project and why did you start it?
Yeah, sure. So when I first really started seriously self-publishing, I didn't know anybody. You know, I was not friends with other self-publishing author. I had some author friends, but we were all aspiring authors, you know. None of us knew what we were doing. And so I kind of, you know, I put my first book out there and I had no point of reference on were my sales good, were my sales bad, where it, not necessarily like where do I rank, but you know, I had no concept of if what I was doing was effective. And so now at this point in my career, you know, whenever the convention winds down and all of us authors retire back to the bar for BarCon, yeah, we'll sit around and we'll swap, you know, how did sales go today? Oh, that's cool. Yeah. What did you do? And that's all very useful information, but typically you have to be, you know, in the in crowd that knows go to the bar to go hang out with the authors and ask questions.
Yeah.
So because I didn't have that kind of resource available to me, I thought, well, you know, they say be the change you want to see. And I was like, well, why don't I just start doing that? And in hopes of one, offering a resource to, you know, folks that are kind of following my general path. But then also in hopes that other authors might, maybe they don't have to be as transparent as I am. I get I get real transparent. But you know, even if it was just more broad strokes, like for me on my project, every month I do a blog post where I recap how my sales went that month, if how my social media grew or shrank. You know, if I quit using a social media, that's typically where I explain why I stopped using it or why I started using a new one. If I tried some new sales strategy, I talk about it there. And so you can kind of see over time, you can see every, and I show like, you know, this month I made $300. Last month I made $212. And then over time you can see, and it maps out and you can see how I've consistently kind of gradually grown. And then I also, you know, those are every month. And then I do other things as it's warranted. So every time I do a convention, I will do a recap about it. So that if there are folks like, you know, I've been thinking about doing like applying for that convention, I wonder if it would be worth it, they can look and see. And I'll, you know, I'll be transparent. It's like, look, this show, I made a lot of money, or this show, I barely broke even, things like that. And then I also do the same with like my book launches. I break down, this book has launched. I track my launch over, I don't do a launch day. I do typically like a launch 5 day, because that's how the Amazon sales typically run. So I track that. And so you can see like, hey, this is how many books he sold, how many books he gave away, you know, and how that looks, and like, what did I do this launch that maybe I didn't do last launch that helped or hurt? So,
right.
But yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting. I was actually going to ask what you had gained, which had learned from this project so far, but it sounds like that's part of it.
Yeah, no, for me, it's what I would say that the transparency project, big picture, I haven't learned anything from that, because it's all like, you know, it's just things I'm learning on along the way that I'm throwing out there. But what it has done is it has, if I can put something in an Excel spreadsheet, I am happy as a clam. So I'm kind of a stats junkie. And so I had always, you know, tracked like word counts over time, because I, you know, you always hear that early on. You got to write it. You got to write a million words to learn your craft. And I wanted to know when I hit a million words. And so, you know, things like that. Well, this has caused me to be really good. And there's accountability every month. I have to do this. I have to put this up. So I have accountability that is making sure that I am tracking all these statistics. And so now I can go back and look. I'm now getting to see, I have data that I can compare over years. So like, I can just say right now, February for, at this point in the month, book sales for me through Amazon seem to be a little sluggish this month. We'll see how it ends. But now I have enough historical data that I can somewhat start looking back and see, was this an anomaly? Or, hey, you know, February is just kind of a slow month for books. So yeah. That's where the personal value has really come, is it's helping me understand the kind of the bigger forces at play, and helps me not get so down on myself.
Oh yeah, no, I totally understand. Yeah, it's interesting, just because you know, we field a lot of questions from writers who are wanting to know whether or not they should abandon the traditional route and go the self-publishing route, and it's not a small conversation.
Oh, no.
But it seems like having something like that would at least help inform writers a little bit more into what it may be like, not necessarily what it will be like, but what it may be like in terms of the numbers of what you're doing. But if you were to take your experience and look at it from the pros and cons of the self-publishing route versus traditional route, what would that look like for you, that list?
So the quick one-liner is, the you know, the great thing about self-publishing is you have all the control. Mm-hmm. And the terrible thing about self-publishing is you have all the control.
Yeah.
And so kind of for me, the rubric that I look at when I am advising people on should they go self-published versus traditionally published is you should go self-publishing if you either have the ability to learn a wide variety of skills, or you have the money to pay someone to do the things that you cannot learn to do. You can, if you, again, going back to the transparency, you can see that my early books had, you know, every time I did a book launch, when I was calculating when do I break even, I had to calculate in the cost of making a cover. Well, my COVID project was learning enough graphic design that I would not always have to hire someone to do things like that. And so, you know, I paid someone to make my first cover and I hired them to do the second cover. And I wasn't really happy with how it turned out, but because I paid the extra money to get the source file, by that point I had kind of learned enough, I was able to take that source file and use it as a template to now make a cover I was happy with. So that brought down the costs for me. And so every book I put out, my goal is to make it cheaper to put out than the last one. And at this point, pretty much my only expense is editing costs. Mm-hmm. And that's just always going to go up. Editors got to eat. My editor, I love her to death, Cleo. She's fantastic, but her prices go up over time, as they should. You know, Inflation hits her just as hard as hits me. So that expense is always going to go up to some degree. But the goal is to get all other costs eliminated. And because I'm somewhat technically adept, I've been able to learn how to do most of the things that, so I don't have to pay someone. And I'm always on the prowl for ways to do that. When I released the omnibus editions of my books, of my Jubal County Saga, each one is three books and combined into one volume. And when I was looking at that, I had my, you know, way of uploading books to Amazon had been, you know, format it in Word, upload it, preview it, see 8 mistakes, take it down, fix those 8 formatting mistakes, upload it, realize for whatever reason, 6 of those mistakes didn't actually get fixed, take it back down, repeat that process 30 to 40 times. Mm-hmm. It was miserable. So I was like, God, if I'm trying to get 3 books into one, I don't have the bandwidth to do that. So I hired someone, and it cost me $200 to get them to lay out that omnibus and to kind of take my cover art and make it into the uploadable cover file. But now I have bought Atticus and learned how to use it, and it's stupid easy to use.
Oh, really?
And so now I'm anticipating I'm never going to have to pay someone to do that for me again, because I don't know if they used Vellum or they used Atticus, but whoever I paid or who I paid, they used one of those two products, I'm virtually certain. And yeah, Now I have one of those products and have learned how to use it. So so that to me is the biggest differentiator between the two is, you know, if and it comes and then part of that calculus is your what's your goal? If you just want a book out there with your name on it, yeah, just pay some folks to do that. You know, you can hire someone on Fiverr that will, you don't need to learn how to upload a book to KDP. You can pay someone $30 on Fiverr to upload your book to KDP and you never have to worry about it. But if you're seriously looking at making this a sustainable business, you've got to wear a lot of hats.
Yeah.
And that I like wearing a lot of hats. I like the control to a degree. Mm-hmm. But it is a lot. I spend more time doing stuff behind the scenes than actually writing at this point.
Sure. Yeah. And I think that's a very common theme that I've heard from people is if you want to do this and you want to sell books, you have to be ready to learn and wear a lot of hats, but you have to be ready to hustle. You got to work for it.
Yeah. That's kind of the common theme I see is the folks who get frustrated and quit. They've written the book. Maybe they've written a bunch of books, but you know, you can't just write the books and throw them out there into the world and expect people to stumble on them. You know, some people get incredibly lucky in that regard, but most of us are not. So
right. That is very true.
Yeah.
You mentioned the editing that you have to do, and not that we have to get all transparent here and get actual numbers or anything, but if I'm a writer who's looking at self-publishing, and it is imperative that these folks get their work edited, don't just print it. What general cost for, let's say, a developmental and even line edit might they run into?
So there's a broad range, and there can be an element of luck here. I will say, one, you absolutely have to pay to get your book edited. I can already hear people say, oh, but my uncle's an English professor, or oh, my coworker's kid, yeti. No, you need separation from your editor, and you need a financial relationship. Like, I just cannot emphasize this enough. I really swear by this. Now, as for costs, it is definitely going to vary depending on what your needs are. You know, if you're just doing a simple proofreading, you know, a few hundred bucks. If you're doing line edits, you're probably going to start at closer to 1,000. It depends on the length of your book, of course. Anything beyond that, I mean, it's not uncommon. I've seen books be edited for $2,000 to $5,000, depending on, you know, complex developmental edits. And you've got to be very careful with this, because you may hire someone to do, you know, pay $3,000 for a developmental edit and not realize that they don't actually do proofreading, you know? And so now you got to go back and hire a proofreader now.
Good questions to ask before you hire someone.
Yeah. So in my case, because I had experience with being published before and having had people read my stuff, I was confident enough in the overall structure of the story that I did not pay for like developmental edits. My editor, I'm kind of a hybrid. I'm paying her kind of a hybrid, mostly proofing. That's the main thing. But she does do some line editing in there. But because it's just the nature of my books, they're shorter books, and each book is actually two novellas. And so the story structures are a lot of times less complex, even though they are mysteries, they're not quite as complex as your more full length novel length mysteries. So that was a calculated gamble on my part. It could have backfired horribly on me, but it didn't. So there is an element of that, and that, you know, this may be, you know, if you have some beta readers that you actually trust, like they're strangers from the internet reading your book and giving you legitimate feedback, and they're not catching big developmental type issues, then maybe you take that gamble as well. But editing is going to be your biggest expense, and the rule of thumb is pay for the biggest amount of editing that you can get,
right?
Typically.
Yeah.
So,
well, you mentioned, yeah, I understand. I know it's such a necessary thing though, you know, forking over the money that is required for it it pays for itself. I mean, you get that story. You don't want to have errors in your book, and you don't want to have, you know, any kind of plot gaps or character issues or anything. So it really helps.
I'm actually getting my first book re-edited, or correction, it has been re-edited. I have to go in and fix all the things, but my first edit, and here's another weird thing about when I got my first book edited, I hired someone off Fiverr. When I was hiring folks off Fiverr, I feel like it was slightly more reputable because AI was not as prevalent. Now I would be a lot more cautious about hiring people off of Reddit, or not Reddit, Fiverr, because a lot of these folks are setting up shop and they're just running your manuscript through Pro Writing Aid and calling it a day. or they're making your book cover with Midjourney and calling it a day, and that's awful. So, so you know, user beware. But I hired an editor, and she did a great job. But she was British, and my books are very Southern, and she went in and fixed every bit of Southern dialogue, and I had to go back and unfix everything, and so a lot of things slipped through the cracks because of that. So when I hired my editor for books 2 through 6, she edits all my stuff now. I had to be like, look, I'm not trying to be creepy, but I need to know where you live because I need to know that you understand Southern dialogue. And she's like, oh, I'm from Texas. I was like, all right, cool, you get it, let's go.
we're good
yeah.
Well, you had talked about Fiverr and you know, the sort of red flags that you have to be careful of there with AI and everything. But what if we dug into like the do's and don'ts of self-publishing? In fact, I'd actually rather just focus on the don'ts if we can.
Yeah.
Just because I feel like, you know, we want to kind of keep people from making mistakes.
I'd say right now the most topical don't is don't use AI. Mm-hmm. There's a fiscal reason I would argue an ethical reason. The fiscal reason is there's a large enough, vocal enough presence of people online who will just tear you to shreds because you're using AI. And the reason that that is the case is because ethically, if you were using AI to make your cover, you have just taken money out of the mouth of an artist. I don't want AI writing books taking money out of my mouth. So I don't want artists using AI to write books the same way they don't want me using AI to make covers. Mm-hmm. So for me, this is one of those ethically creatives should band together on this one.
Yeah.
And that also goes to audiobooks. Amazon is currently rolling out their big beta program for you can, with a click of a button, they will convert your book into an audiobook. And I hate it. And so there are enough options out there that you don't have to do that. You can do things like royalty share where you don't have to pay money up front. That's what I'm doing. My first audiobook comes out next month, if all goes well. And I'm doing royalty share because, I didn't have the money to pay. I had the money to pay a voice talent for one or maybe 2 books, but to get all 6 books done, I did not have that kind of money up front. So we agreed to a royalty split. So there's no money up front. We're going to split the profits. Cool. So AI is the big thing. I'm going to give a bit of advice that will run a little counter to what a lot of people are going to hear, but you got to use it with a grain of salt. Everyone will tell you, if you're writing urban fantasy, go to Amazon and look at the top sellers in the urban fantasy category and make your cover look like that. And that is generally sound advice. That said, I don't take it, and I'm a contrarian in that regard. I do the opposite, partly because I had a vision for what I wanted my covers to look like long before the books were ever done. I knew what my covers were going to look like. But my covers at first glance do not read as urban fantasy. Well, because most of the places I'm promoting my books, I'm known as an urban fantasy writer and I'm in a urban fantasy space. So my covers stand out a lot more than most people's covers. It also clues people in that, you know, this guy's probably writing something a little different. And meth wizards are a little different.
That is definitely different. Yes, I will give you that.
Yeah. So, unless you are really good at graphic design, you really shouldn't make your own cover. You can do what I did and go a little contrarian, or you can go with the conventional advice and make a cover that fits your genre. But either way, you really should hire someone to make you a cover. Unless you're a lot better at graphic design than I was when I got started. Mm-hmm. So, because, you know, they say don't judge a book by its cover, but that's literally the point of a cover. For you to judge it.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing that we were raised with that saying, but I tell that to writers all the time. It's like the cover design is a pivotal part if you are in a position to have control over that from a traditional standpoint or self-publishing if you're doing it yourself. But you want to make that cover look good, because just what it not only does it have to look good on a shelf and draw the eye, but it has to look good as a thumbnail, so that all those little online sites catch your eye too.
So those would be the two things you really do. There's no getting around it. You're going to have to shell out money for those two things. And 98% of the time, cases, you're going to have to do that. I would say that, man, the big things not to do. I would say that for the most part, like I have screwed up so many things along the way. And I would caution folks that there are very few mistakes that can't be recovered from. And so I would not worry as much about making a mistake unless money is involved. Like, yeah, you don't want to waste a bunch of money. That's bad. But as long as a mistake doesn't involve, like, oh man, I just paid this editor $1,000 for the wrong types of edits, don't worry about it. But even on those, like, I know a lot in the self-publishing world, there's a faction that really pushes for like rapid releases and getting those books out there, and there's a whole mindset around that. But for me, I kind of come with the mindset that this is not a sprint. I have written these books. I do not have to race out there and get the next book out. I have not sold my books to everyone who could ever possibly want a Meth Wizard book.
Obviously not, because I don't have one yet. So now I know.
Yeah. So like, that's the thing is, don't let yourself be ruled by fear, I guess what I would say there. You can make some mistakes along the way. And as long as those mistakes are not, sharing white power memes on Twitter or whatever, pretty much everything can be recoverable from. Just be a good person.
Yeah.
Be a good person. And then, if you make some mistakes, it's going to be okay. I guess those would probably be my big takeaways is if you have a good cover and your book is edited well, you have a good book that's been edited well and you have a good cover, that is 95% of the battle. The other 5% is just marketing.
Yeah.
And that's a nightmare.
it is. There's so many ways to do that. So what have you seen in terms of sales between ebooks and the actual printed book? Now, if we exclude when you go to conferences or conventions or anything like that, and you have a table to sell stuff on a regular basis, do you see better movement from ebooks print, or is it running kind of even?
I sell more ebooks if you exclude in-person sales. I sell more ebooks, and then my books are currently, and for the foreseeable future, are in Kindle Unlimited. And so I get again, this is kind of a slow month, but I get a pretty good amount of page reads on there. But I will say that the Kindle Unlimited page reads really only started to kick in when I got probably like my fourth book out. And people who read in Kindle Unlimited, a lot of them really want series, and the more books, the better. So they like to binge a series, and my series is very bingeable. It's kind of, I didn't set out with that mindset of like, oh, let me write a bingeable series, but it is as reviews have come in, there have been a number of like, oh, this reads like a Netflix series. It's very bingeable. It's very digestible. And the other thing is, especially like if you're just getting started, people are more likely to take the gamble on you as an unknown author with a smaller price point. So if they can get the ebook for $3, there a lot of folks are more likely to do that than to gamble, you know, 15, 20, however much you're charging for. Sure. If you and I, we met at the Atlanta Writing Workshop, and there was a number of people there that I talked with, and I did some kind of mentor sessions there where I looked over their first 10 pages. And one thing I kind of kept emphasizing to them is you have to think that on Amazon, if they do the if they do the preview, these 10 pages are going to be the pages that you have to hook someone. So make it as good as possible. Mm-hmm. That goes both ways. If you're trying to get traditionally published, your first page needs to be a real banger, you know. Mm-hmm. But that also applies for self-published, especially when you're new. Like at this point, there's a lot of folks who they see that book 5 or book 6 came out, they don't preview. They liked books 1 through 4, they're just going to buy it. You know, Amazon let them know it was out, they're going to go buy it. Yeah. So it's less of an issue in later books, but you know, especially your first book, the first book in a series, those first few pages have to really be, you have to be on top of your game.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. You had mentioned Atticus and Fiverr earlier, and I was curious if there were any other tools or resources that you would advise a writer, whether chasing self-pub or even traditional publishing, they should look into.
Yes, I do. I actually have a list. So this is something else. Like besides my transparency project, I have like a whole education tab on my website with a lot of free resources that you can go check out. And I actually just made a list, and it's on there. So I'm just, because I know I'll forget stuff. In the podcasting space, I use Audacity because it's free, and that's how I edit. I use for cover design and making my marketing tools, things like that, I use Affinity. Affinity is a direct competitor to Adobe. And rather than Adobe, which has a monthly subscription model, they have you buy it once and you own it. You buy a perpetual license and you own it till you die. And so I'm a big fan of that. They have direct competitors their three products are a book layout product, a photo editing product, and a vector design product. And so I use Designer when I'm doing more RPG style that like have complex layouts, because I do some indie RPG game design. And then with my book covers, I use Designer, which is their vector design program. And then I don't use their photo design program because I don't take pictures that need photo.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then I use, like I said, I use Atticus now for book layouts. I got it. A lot of this stuff, like I didn't buy it till it went on sale. Like a lot of stuff I'd been like kind of on the fence about it, or, you know, at the last Cyber Monday sale, an author I'm friends with, Ben Meeks, was like, "Hey, yeah, we were just talking. You know how we were just talking to Richard Fierce about Pro Writing Aid? It's on sale." And so I was like, "Cool." So I bought Pro Writing Aid and Atticus on Cyber Monday because they both went on sale. And Pro Writing Aid is basically Grammarly for genre fiction. Is kind of the way I would describe it. I haven't got as much use out of that yet.
Right.
We'll see. But that was something that it was also, you buy it once, there's no monthly fees or anything like that. I do not do anything that involves monthly fees, except for my web host, that and my podcast hosting. Those are monthly fees. There's just, that's the industry standard there. But yeah. Anything else, I want a license that I can, and that's why I use Google Drive for, well, now I use Atticus for writing. I actually write straight into Atticus now. I use it as my word processor. But before that, and I still use it for a lot of things, Google Drive. I use Google Drive for writing, and then I would export the files into Word to format, and right. It was a nightmare. So now any writing that I've done that's in my Google Drive, I'm just exporting it into Atticus for layout. And the book I'm writing now, I was about, I don't know, like 12,000 words into it when I started using Atticus. And every word I've written since then has gone straight into Atticus. And it has a built-in goal feature where you can tell, like, I want to finish this book by this day. This is how many words I want it to be. And it will tell you, okay, hey, and you tell it what days you write. So I typically write Monday through Friday. And so it'll tell you, okay, you have to write, for me right now, it says, I think it's, as of today, it's like 1,091 words to hit your goal. And so that for me is very motivating. I respond well to some folks hate that kind of thing. I respond well to that kind of thing.
Gotcha.
So that's been a neat feature. So I definitely recommend Atticus, like that's big. Atticus is the PC competitor to Vellum, which is the Mac product. So if you have a Mac and you want something like Atticus, it's Vellum. Okay. Vellum is actually the older, more established product. And it was intensely popular, like so popular that someone's like, man, all these authors are doing it and loving it. I wish we had something. And so someone did. They made Atticus. And so.
Gotcha. I have heard of Atticus, but I've never really looked into it. So now I'm motivated to.
Yeah. Just, and if you're on the fence about it, wait till like Black Friday, Cyber Monday, something like that. It'll go on sale. I want to say I got it for a little over $100. And yeah. When you consider the last time I paid someone to do book layout, I paid them $200 and I had to do that twice for two different omnibuy. Yeah. If I use it to lay out one omnibuy, it's already made its money back twice over. So,
Well, cool. No, I appreciate that. Well, we're running short on time here, but before we wrap things up, I do want to come back to the dreaded M word and talk a little bit about marketing. Because it's, you know, gone are the days when you're paying for ads, you know, in papers and stuff like that. Not that you can't pay for ads online or anything. I'm curious what kind of marketing you do for free versus what you do that you might pay for.
At this point, I do not use any form of paid, marketing. I'd always heard such mixed things about using Amazon ads that I never want to take. I'm also very unlucky, so I knew how that was going to go for me. And then at the time where I was looking at maybe doing some Facebook ads, is when Facebook got basically like they had to shut off a lot of how they do things. And so ads quit working effectively for a long time there. And so because of that, I was like, well, I'm just going to really focus on word of mouth and organic marketing, with the idea being that if I can get enough people to read it and love it and talk about it, it'll eventually become a somewhat sustaining, ever-growing, you know, patch of kudzu of word of mouth.
Yeah.
And so I do a lot of quirky things, and like I dress up as my main character and go stand on a street corner. So I'm dressed like as a redneck wizard on a street corner, you know, mullet wig, the whole possum by my side, like the whole shebang. So I do quirky things like that because I'm a big proponent of, if you're creative, that is fantastic. There's billions of other creative people. If you want to be successful, you've got to figure out how to use your creativity to get noticed. Mm-hmm. So it's on my to-do list for this year. I'm going to start playing around with Facebook ads because they've have since fixed it, and apparently they're working better than ever. Take that with a huge grain of salt. But you do not have to pay for ads to be successful. That said, if you're not going to pay for ads, you really have to step up your game on in-person events. You need to be going to events, doing panels, doing workshops, doing vending, things like that. Because that's how you're, especially with someone like me, that's like meth wizard is perhaps not the easiest sell. being able to get in front of someone and pitch it to them is really effective a lot of times. So you do not have to pay for ads, but you're going to have to compensate in other ways.
Yeah. The talking about the convention side of things, are those generally productive for you? And then as we're kind of winding things up here, what if I'm a writer wanting to get involved with conventions, how do I start that?
Yeah. Yes, it's intensely, intensely valuable. One, it is very rare that I do not have an event where I at least break even. And most conventions I make money that I'm a vendor at. But the bigger payoffs long term are the connections you make. You know, when you're in the trenches with the other authors selling books, you make friendships, you learn about opportunities. You go back to BarCon and you hear, oh, that guy came and talked to you. Oh, he told you what? Yeah, no, he's a scam artist. You know, people will clue you in on things like that. Mm-hmm. Authors gossip a lot. I'm mostly self-published, but I started traditionally published. And I recently just signed a book deal with Falstaff Books. And I got my book deal at a convention. And then like two conventions later is where I actually signed the contract, you know, because we were like, oh, well, don't bother trying to fax this. I'll see you at Chattacon and sign it there kind of deal.
Yeah.
So if you want to get started with it, go to conventions. You need to kind of understand the lay of the land. But I'm a huge proponent. This is another thing I harp on all the time. Just ask. The first panel I ever was on was at a small convention, and I just like, hey guys, I've been doing this kind of self-publishing thing. I know a lot about the lay of the land of publishing. Would you let me do a panel on how to get published where I talk about self-published versus traditionally published? And they said, sure, go for it. Mm-hmm. And so I did that at smaller conventions to kind of build up my resume. To then I started going to bigger conventions and say, hey, I'd love to be a panelist. I'd love to be a guest. I'd be happy to be a moderator. And here's what I have done. And so I've done that enough that at this point, like I'm a attending professional at Dragon Con this year. Like last year, I did 6 panels for Dragon Con, not as an attending professional, but I did that just by asking, or I had made connections with people at previous conventions to the point where I was like, hey, look, if you have something you want to throw me on, just throw me on it. And so I was on a panel next to Sherilyn Kenyon, which, nice. You know, she sold like 70 million books. And then I have not broke 5,000 books yet. So getting close, getting real close. But so a little bit of difference there. But it was just because I had networked through conventions and Nancy Knight was like, oh, I'll throw you on this. Sure.
Yeah, we go from the dreaded M word to the dreaded N word. I know writers tend to shy away from the idea of networking, but it's so invaluable to go to these conventions. And no matter what you're looking for, whether you're looking for an in to become a speaker, whether you're looking for a connection that might lead to publishing, or whether you're just looking for a good group of writer friends that you can each lean on, it's so invaluable to hit these things up. And an incredibly worthy investment in yourself to pay to go attend these. That's great advice.
For sure.
Well, Bob, I hate to wrap this up because I'm enjoying the conversation, and I feel like we've kind of just barely just touched the surface of what it's like to be a self-published author. But I really appreciate your time and your expertise today.
Yeah, no problem. I've had a blast. Always happy to come back at some point in the future. We can work it out later. So
sure, we'll call this episode 1A, whatever. I don't know. We'll come up with something. Part 1.
I love it. I love it.
To be continued. ..
Yeah.
All right. Well, I thank you for being here, and I wish you all the best with your upcoming books. And I am really looking forward to digging into the adventures of Howard Marsh.
I appreciate it. I appreciate the opportunity, and looking forward to hanging out at the next convention.
All right, cool. Thanks, Bob.